Thanks for joining us at Cults to Consciousness. This storytelling podcast is meant to be for entertainment purposes only and does not substitute for any medical advice. We may discuss triggering topics, and we ask that you make your personal mental health a priority. Lastly, the opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the host.
Even as a little girl, they began heavily indoctrinating us, even just in little primary Sunday school that we had. One of the stories I remember learning from this very sweet, loving woman was the story of Abraham and how he had to be willing to take his son Isaac up onto a mountain and sacrifice him to God. We were taught that if we were asked to take someone's life, if God told us to do that, we needed to be prepared. We were also taught the story of Solomon and Bathsheba and Solomon with all his wives. So we were taught from an early age, you know, that it was God's chosen men could get away with really bad behaviors and have all these wives that they wanted and even take other men's wives. And little did I know at the time, that's where I came from.
Hey, my name is Shalise Ansola, and this is Cults to Consciousness, where we discuss leaving high-demand religions or organizations and finding healing and independence through awareness and true individual sovereignty. If you're only listening and you want to see our faces, you can go to our YouTube at Cults to Consciousness, where you can like and subscribe, join in on the conversation. It's so nice to see those amazing words of encouragement that you leave for our guests. It means so much to them. It means a lot to us, and it does boost the algorithm so more people can see this and be aware of what's going on out there in the world. So today's guest, you've recently seen her sister, and we've also done a live with her. You may have seen the documentary on Hulu that just came out, Daughters of the Cult, which follows the LeBaron group, which is a fundamentalist Mormon breakoff who continue to practice polygamy. And this group specifically, this is the first time we've really been talking about them, although we've mentioned them in other fundamentalist Mormon interviews. They really focus heavily on blood atonement. We're going to get into what that means as best we can. But for now, thank you so much for joining us, Celia.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course. It's so great to talk to you. I watched the whole documentary and you did such a great job. And I'm sure it's been a whirlwind with this coming out. What has it been like for you since everything released?
Well, my sister Anna is the one who got me involved in this project. She, of course, has her book, The Polygamous Daughter. Yes. And everybody should go get it. She's the one that put herself out there. And to me, I have always been I felt like that was putting me in too much of a vulnerable position. I didn't want anybody to know that I was part of the LeBaron group ever. So I live my adult life kind of just hiding behind my ex-husband's last name, because I didn't want to be associated with my father and all the atrocities that he committed or caused to be committed. And so this is something I am not at all used to. Anna is. But it is not something that I've ever really tried to make happen or sought after, I guess. But I can see now where there can be some good that could come out of it. And I do want to be part of that redeeming of that LeBaron name.
Yeah. Anna was telling me in our last interview, it may have been after we stopped the camera, that your name, your last name was changed a day or two after the documentary came out back to LeBaron.
Yes. We legally went to the courthouse. She accompanied me, and I am now embracing the name LeBaron. We decided that Irva LeBaron should not get to dirty that name and, you know, make the decision about, he shouldn't be the deciding factor on what it means to be a LeBaron.
Yeah.
So we are out there, we're using the name, and we are proud of so much that our family has accomplished since, you know, our dad passed away and people became unbrainwashed.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note at the beginning of this interview, especially if someone is just now joining and hasn't seen the live and or Anna's interview, that the LeBarons don't believe in the blood atonement anymore. They have disavowed all of Ervil's teachings, correct?
That is 100% correct. There's something, a book that he produced while he was in prison in his final days, just an awful, atrocious book that is just so violent and so incoherent. And it's called The Book of the New Covenant. And there's this narrative out there that says oh, what if one of the children or the grandchildren of Irva LeBaron pick that up and run with it and start carrying out Blood Atonements again? Well, first of all, none of Irval's children believe he was a prophet anymore. Any adult looking at that document can see that it is literally just the rantings of a madman. Mm. So no one is going to pick that book up and say, oh, this looks like real. Let's follow these teachings. They're just awful. And so there's just nobody wants to, nobody will. We're not teaching anything about Irva LeBaron to our children. So there's no grandchild that even will have any reason to even look at it or decide that they need to carry anything out. Like, Blood Atonement is an evil doctrine. We all know that. We do not have the right to decide who God wants to, you know, to do away with. Mm-hmm. We know it's completely lawlessness, and we don't believe in that or adhere to it in any way.
Yeah. So to give context even further as to where that even came from, I grew up mainstream Mormon, and we talked about the LeBarons being a breakoff group of the mainstream Mormon church. So just a little bit of a background, and correct me if I'm wrong or if you learned this differently. The Blood Atonement was something that was introduced in the early days of Mormonism. It was, I think, most heavily talked about during Brigham Young's time, who was the second prophet of the Mormon church when he went and settled Utah. And essentially, it was just this theology or this belief that if someone wouldn't repent for their sins, it was up to you to slit their throat, spill their blood on the ground. And that was the Blood Atonement. And I think many people have taken that and run with it. I mean, we've seen the Lafferty cases that was actually going on kind of around the same time as Irval. Mm-hmm. And nice. If you want to watch Under the Banner of Heaven, it's so well done. It's based on a book and it's all true. And it's terrifying to think about that people were actually carrying this out. But I wanted to provide that context so people knew that Irval didn't just come up with it on his own either. This was from original Mormon doctrine. And if you really dive into it, you can find more about the history. So is that how you learned about it as well?
Yes, I learned from a very young age. We had the Journal of Discourses, and a lot of fundamentalist Mormons follow the Journal of Discourses, because those books are they took the teachings of, well, most of the, what I read, I think, was Joseph Smith. I mean, Brigham Young, but Joseph Smith is in there too, I'm sure. But they used to keep track of all the sermons and all the mm-hmm. teachings. And one of the doctrines was that doctrine of Blood Atonement. And Brigham Young taught that some sins are so egregious that they can't be covered by the blood of Christ, and somebody must atone with their own blood. The way I learned it as a child is their blood needed to hit the ground so that it could cry out to God for atonement, so that they could be forgiven and not end up in eternal damnation. So in a very twisted way, it was a way you're helping people get to heaven right. who otherwise never would. That's how they could get good, sincere people to do these horrible atrocities. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I was raised on.
Yeah, it's terrifying to think about. And I didn't even know this was a thing until I left the church years later. I was like, wait, what was going on back in the day? There were a lot of very questionable things going on in those early days before they disavowed certain things, became more of the polished, happy, shiny Mormons that we know today. Mm-hmm. And there's still a lot of harms, I believe, going on in the mainstream Mormon church. We've talked about that before, but that's an episode for another day. So let's get into your story then. So your origin story, I think, is really interesting to even talk about how and where you were born.
Yeah, I was born in a fundamentalist Mormon cult commune in Colonia LeBaron, Chihuahua, Mexico. It was a colony in Mexico that was founded by my grandfather, and it was named after my family. So it was the LeBaron colony is how you say it in English, but I've always said Colonia LeBaron. That's mm-hmm. where I was born, in super impoverished circumstances. I think we have intermittent electricity, if any at all. There was no running water. When I was born, my mother always told me the story that I was born on the kitchen table, because the midwife, who was just a lay midwife, one of the members of the organization, came to deliver me, and she wanted my mom to be higher up so she could more, you know, facilitate the birth a little bit easier. So they took the mattress off the floor and put it on the kitchen table for me to be birthed. And in those circumstances, just even bathing was, the children was a huge process. They had to boil water on the stove and they had to go get the water from across the street and pump it out of a well and carry it across, get it boiled. So when we were lining up to get bathed, lots and lots of children, because it wasn't just my mom's children, it was other wives' children too, that she was often taking care of so that the moms could go across the border of the U.S. to do some kind of job, very low-paying job. But in Mexico, those low-paying jobs, it went a long way. So the other couple of wives whose children my mom would watch were gone. So my mom just took care of all of them. But the bathing, they would line them up, littlest to biggest, and bathe them in the same water. And because they figured the littler ones have less space, you know, less skin area to get dirty. So they would just go bigger and bigger. And then we would just get a final rinse, you know, with some clean water. And it was just like once a week for church, probably, or Saturday night before church.
If you had to guess how many kids were all being taken care of by your mom, what would you say?
So it depends on when you're talking, because there were so many different circumstances and so many different houses that we lived in. There were a few times where it was just my mom and her kids, but that was very rare. Usually it was other of my mom's children. And there's a couple of stories I can tell you about living in Colonia Levarón that my mom told me. They did a lot of things kind of communally, like even meals and stuff. So it was really like a commune, but it was more benevolent. It became very much darker later. But it is all about control and patriarchy for sure. But my mom said that there were times where there were like weevils in the wheat and they would just sift them out and we would still eat the mush that was made from that because they couldn't afford to just throw it away. Another story, she said they had big 5-gallon buckets of honey to sweeten our mush and, you know, put on our bread. And one time someone left the lid off of the 5-gallon bucket and the cat fell into the honey and suffocated and died.
Poor kitty.
They pulled the cat out and they still ate the honey.
No, I was like, don't tell me you still ate the honey.
I know. Yes. Well, I asked my mom, I just begged her to tell me because I was really little when I heard the story. I said, please tell me I didn't eat any of that honey. She said, no, I think you were too little because you can't give kids honey before a year old to prevent botulism.
Yeah.
But the good thing about it, the good thing I learned later is that germs cannot live in honey, and honey, you can eat it forever.
Yeah.
Like they have found honey in pyramids and it's still edible.
Whoa.
And not dangerous.
It makes it a little bit better, but still I don't know.
What about the cat hair?
Yeah.
But those were the conditions, just super, super impoverished conditions.
Yeah.
But they were the kingdom of God, you know, God's chosen people. He really looks after them.
Right. And so another thing that we maybe failed to mention, I don't know if I did already, is the polygamy. That was a big part of being a fundamentalist Mormon. And so your mom was, do you remember what number of wife she was to Ervil?
I think she was number 4, if I'm not mistaken. I believe she was number 4.
Okay. And he ended up having about 13 or 14 wives.
Mm-hmm. It's commonly believed that it was 13, but we've found another one that was married to him such a short time, probably months, I don't even think a year. And then she ran away and was never heard from again. But there definitely was one more.
So within all of those wives, I assume birth control was out of the question. Were these wives having how many kids on average each?
I mean, my mother total with, you know, because she was married prior to marrying Ervil. She had 12 children.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And so birth control was an absolute sin. You could not practice birth control. And there's so much regulation in sexuality in these organizations. Everything is just, you know, there's not real freedom. They even try to control your sexual activity. Mm-hmm. I was definitely taught that women were supposed to bring as many children into the world as possible for God's glory, because there's spirit children waiting to come to the earth. Mm-hmm. And then it fills up this planet the way God intended. And it's biblical too. You know, there's things in there that they would preach about, that they would, you know, reference in the Old Testament, things about somebody named Omar who spilled his seed on the ground and God punished him because he was like not permitted to do anything to prevent children coming into the earth.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I remember that as a Mormon growing up, the whole, did you ever watch Saturday's Warriors or have you seen it? The movie, the Mormon movie?
I've heard of it, but we never watched it, at least not with my growing up. But my, I mean, maybe my older siblings would know that had a more stable life down in the colony. Mm. Once, you know, we left the colony, everything was so scattered and so unstable. And we didn't own things. Like, you couldn't have a house where you had a lot of stuff because we would move so often. My mother never put anything on the walls. There were not lamps. There were not pretty carpets. We just had to keep our home situation super, super sparse so that we could just pick up a few clothing items, and then kids walk out the door with their belongings. We often didn't have beds, furniture. Like, we had a table usually, but not even always in Mexico. It was a very, very minimalist lifestyle, not comfortable.
Yeah. I imagine that would be really difficult as far as cooking and cleaning if you don't really have a lot of things or if you need to move things around. Do you remember there being lots of pots and pans and dishes?
There were times where we literally had, you know, 15, 20 children in a house. And so having enough dishes for that number of children is very difficult. And we were super poor. We didn't have money. So a lot of things were, you know, from Goodwill boxes or, you know, sometimes we'd buy them from the secondhand stores, but usually we just kind of stole them out of the Goodwill boxes, which we called gift boxing. We would use margarine out of tubs, lidded tubs of margarine, and we would never throw them away. We would always save them and collect them, and those would be our cereal bowls or our bean bowls. Mm. And so instead of actual dishes, we just had a mishmash of whatever was cheap in the margarine aisle.
Okay. So now that I have a better idea of your living situation, and I know it fluctuated and changed because you moved quite a bit, I'm wondering about the theological side, about the faith-based side. When we spoke to Anna, she was saying she didn't really recall learning much about Mormonism in general because you guys were always on the run. Was that the same for you, or was there a point in your life where you do remember learning the doctrine of Mormonism?
I was absolutely, definitely more indoctrinated than Anna was. I was fully indoctrinated. I always knew God was watching every moment, every thought. And I wanted to I have this, you know, perfectionist tendency. So I always wanted to please God. And I wanted to, you know, just be as holy and pure, as celestial as I could possibly be. So that included always being cheerful and happy, and never feeling sorry for myself. Mom stressed a lot. She would tell us actually that feeling sorry for yourself is the first sign of insanity. Wow. And there was a problem with insanity within the LeBaron bloodline.
Oh, really?
And so that was really scary to think about that. And so I always kept myself as positive as I could, even within myself and within my own thoughts. So that brainwashing was deep. I wasn't allowed to have negative feelings or thoughts. I couldn't have anger. I couldn't have disappointment. I couldn't have complaints. It just had to be obey, be compliant, and just be content with whatever you're given, whatever little paltry things you are allowed to have.
So do you remember learning about the different kingdoms, the levels of heaven, and wanting to strive for the celestial kingdom?
Absolutely. Being celestial was top of mind. I was told that I was born into the covenant, and that I was a celestial spirit before arriving here on the earth and being born. And I did everything that I could to live up to that and to make good on that, because I was always taught that where much is given, much is expected. Mm-hmm. And I was given celestial knowledge, and I was given, you know, God's true church on the face of the earth. So I knew that I had a very, very high standard to live up to, and I did everything in my power to live up to it. It meant a lot to me.
Yeah. Did you ever realize that you were a fundamentalist version of the mainstream church? Did you ever come across regular Latter-day Saints?
Yes. Well, it was like as a teenager, you know, 17, 18, this is going to be funny to anybody that listens to this that's mainstream Mormon, but I went to Utah to serve a mission for my cult.
That's right.
To convert Mormons to the real truth. Because in the way we were always taught was that the LDS church, the modern day Mormons, abandoned the truth, mm-hmm. which if you look at, you know, we were reading the Journal of Discourses. We knew what the truth was. And it's repeated in the Journal of Discourses by, you know, Brigham Young especially. I don't know why we read a lot of Brigham Young stuff, but I know there were others. But Brigham Young's is always the one that sticks in my mind. He taught that this could not leave the earth. This was the doctrine. Polygamy could never be taken from the earth, that the only way to the celestial kingdom is to have multiple wives, and that you can never stop this doctrine. So when Wilford Woodruff gave the manifesto and said, no more polygamy, the fundamentalists said that you can't. It's very, very clear that the prophets taught that this is how it must be. Mm-hmm. So we would, you know, we thought we had the truth based on all of the things that were written by the early prophets. We were taught that the Mormon church apostatized and we had to carry forth the kingdom of God. And you have to understand that the Mormon church is more organized and has temples and wards. Mm-hmm. When I grew up, we didn't have any of that. We just had living rooms where we would have put a mishmash of chairs. It just makes me laugh when I think about the struggle that we had and the weird way we believed, and people were still adamant that we were God's chosen. Like, God does not look after his chosen very well. That's how we have to live. But it's embarrassing.
But that's part of the persecution complex, because people say, oh, we're so persecuted, or people are after us, or it's the adversary, it's Satan trying to take us down. And they use that to explain the poverty.
Oh, yes. The persecution was like the police coming after us.
Yeah.
That's what we were taught. For the poverty, it was like, you have to sacrifice for God. Do you want to get to the celestial kingdom? You have to give your heart, might, mind, and strength. So if you have to live with nothing, if you have to live in poverty, if you have to work really hard until your knuckles bleed, then you're doing it for God. It's for a greater glory later.
Oh, man. I want to know more about your childhood, but because you brought it up, I have to know more about this mission. How did that go? Did you, like, what were people's responses to you saying, no, no, polygamy is the way?
We didn't lead with that.
Yeah, of course. I'm sure it was a slow build.
Yeah. So cults, just historically, it's very known that cults ease you into things. So we just started easy. Ten Commandment kind of thing is what we would start with, because we were always taught that the Ten Commandments was the civil law of God. It was telestial material. So, you know, as long as you're not killing your neighbor, not, you know, a lying, cheating, well, that's pretty minimal. You can live in heaven in the terrestrial kingdom if you can do at least that minimal stuff. We were never focusing too much on, you know, the terrestrial. It was always like, you're a telestial being, or, you know, what are you going to do to get to the celestial?
Mm-hmm. Because there's only three.
Mm-hmm. Three. Oh, well, and then, of course, there's outer darkness.
Right.
And I mean, that's where you don't qualify for anything.
I'll meet you there.
Definitely. Everything we did was to strive to be celestial. And we were the one true church of God on earth. So what else are you going to go for? We're trying to, you know, bring in the kingdom of God here on earth.
Yeah. So would you try and just relate to them first and be like, no, we're on the same page with this, this, and this. You guys are just missing this little piece or this little piece.
What's really dumb is we would go to the door with a companion always. And we didn't even lead with we're a church, which was so deceptive and silly. I've heard later from younger siblings that they would go and use the name of a church, but we would go knock on the door and say we were from the Liberty Education Association.
Okay.
So we're starting with the Ten Commandments, that's the, you know, civil law of God. That's the law of liberty. My dad and Dan Jordan came up with that. I have tons of pamphlets still where they were teaching, you know, the law of liberty, which it doesn't seem very free because it has a lot of religion in it. It's not a civil law. They taught it was the civil law of God, but then it talks about God as the first commandment, you know?
Yeah.
So it's ridiculous, but it's what we believed. I've memorized a lot of scripture and they were all really like damnation, like Malachi 4:1-4, you know, for behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wicked shall be stubble. And the day that cometh shall burn them up, saith the Lord of hosts. So there was a lot of fear-based stuff that we would quote and read. And we're like, you don't want to be part of that gets burned, do you? So, you know, you need to listen to us and And we would talk about the civil law of liberty and teach the commandments, how we interpreted them. And they wanted to bring back a lot of Old Testament stuff, which a lot of people were like, but we have the New Testament now. So there's a lot of that that's done away. Anyway, I'm not a religious person at all. So I look at the Old Testament and all the stuff that I learned, because we focused in my upbringing a lot on the Old Testament. It was a very, very fear-based religion. Mm. And it was all about control. Like, we were taught that if you don't honor your mother and your father, that you're slated for death, because that's what the Old Testament says, that you can stone rebellious children to death. So for me, my religion is be kind and show integrity towards all of God's children.
Yeah. And that's totally fine. We have people from all different faiths come on this channel. Some people go agnostic, some people go more spiritual, some people are still Christian, and that's totally fine. We always say, do whatever feels good for you, as long as you're not hurting someone mm-hmm. else, as long as you are not being controlled in some way and you have that individual sovereignty and that consciousness, then that's great. Do what yes. works for you.
That's right. So my mom had 12 children. There's 7 of us. Of the 12 that are really close, mm-hmm. and we're all in different places. I have my brother who says openly, you know, I'm an atheist. I think all religions are cults. That's my brother, Hiram. Uh-huh. We have Anna and others that are, you know, more leaning towards Christianity. One who still says that she believes someday people will practice polygamy. We just have to really show a lot of respect towards, you know, whatever their faith is.
Yeah.
Or not, you know, or lack thereof.
Yeah, I just think it's great when, even though people have differing opinions, they can still come together and respect each other as a human being. Yeah. I think sometimes that gets lost when people are fighting for one belief or another. And then if you continue to do that, you're still in a cult mentality of I'm right and you're wrong and I don't want anything to do with you right. because you don't believe the same way I do. And something that you had mentioned off camera before we started was how they started using this doctrine to justify bad behavior. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk about what that was like when you started to realize, and probably not at the time when these killings had started, that the adults were trying to indoctrinate the children to be okay with the doctrine of blood atonement and killing for God.
Right. So even as a little girl, on Sundays, we would go to one of my dad's other wives' homes. And she would teach us Sunday school. She was super sweet, really loving person. And they began heavily indoctrinating us, even just in little primary Sunday school that we had in her living room. She would teach us all the little Mormon hymns, popcorn popping on the apricot tree, I am a child of God, yeah. you know, all the little primary songs that they knew, they passed along to us and started teaching us mostly not about Jesus and kindness and love, but mostly things from the Old Testament. And one of the stories I remember learning from this very sweet, loving woman was the story of Abraham and how he had to be willing to take his son Isaac up onto a mountain and sacrifice him to God, his innocent son. He had to be willing to take his son's life if it was asked of him by God. And we were taught that if we were asked to take someone's life, if God told us to do that, we needed to be prepared. We were also taught the story of Solomon and Bathsheba and Solomon with all his wives. So we were taught from an early age to, you know, that it was God's chosen men mm-hmm. could get away with really bad behaviors and have all these wives that they wanted and even take other men's wives. And little did I know at the time, that's where I came from. My father took my mom away from her original husband and took her for himself. My mother was living in Arizona with her husband named Nephi.
Still very Mormon.
Sure, he was a good little Mormon boy. Yes. And when this preacher came into town proselytizing, her husband Nephi met with this preacher along with other people, and he became converted. And this preacher was my father, Ervil. So he became converted because, you know, my dad was really good at scripture. He had the Journal of Discourses. He could prove that the Mormon church did not have the right to take out the law of polygamy. And it was stated very clearly over and over and over again in the Journal of Discourses. So Nephi could see that that didn't make sense, that the Mormon church no longer practiced that. So, and amongst other things, but that was a huge one. And so he told my father that he believed it and he wanted to go, you know, join the camp in Mexico and be part of that organization that had the truth. And Nephi said, but I can't go without my wife and kids. So my father said, okay, we'll bring her to the meetings and we'll talk to her and we'll get her on the right path. And when Nephi approached my mom and said, you know, hey, we need to go listen to this other preacher. He's teaching some stuff that really makes a lot of sense. She was like, no way. That is no way that's happening. I'm a good Mormon girl, because they call themselves Mormon back then.
Yeah.
And there is no way you're taking me away from the one true church that I know it is. And so when she wouldn't cooperate, Nephi went to Ervil and said, I don't know what to do. I can't leave my wife. They had, you know, five children together. So he said, can you come to the house and convert her there, since she won't come to these meetings? So Ervil did. Ervil marched over there with Nephi to the house and came in and started preaching to her. She was immediately smitten. She fell in love with Ervil.
Mm.
And she says that. She died in 2019. She said she's the one who fell in love with Ervil. And when Nephi took his little family to join the compound in Colonia Levarón, she was just shocked and dismayed at the poverty. She was used to living the American lifestyle, and it was all very hard. They had to hand wash everything again, no running water. The hardship was just really intense, but she was a believer now. And so she, you know, began living that life there in Mexico. And Nephi, her husband at the time, went back to Arizona to just finish some things up in Arizona. I don't know if with his job or with the house or whatever, but he went back to Arizona, finished things up there, and then drove back down to Mexico. And when my mother greeted him, she said, I'm sorry, I can't kiss you. You are no longer my husband. I am married to Ervil. Ervil did give him two wives.
Wait, so he took one and he's like, don't worry, here's two others?
I don't know if it happened exactly like that, but that's kind of the way I think it happened. I don't know if it was like immediate he gave him both.
Yeah.
I don't know the history about that, but I do know he ended up with two Latina wives, and my mom was now Ervil's wife. Now, I have to say, Nephi, my mother admitted to the, and she never divorced him legally, but in her mind, she was not married to him. The law of God supersedes by 1,000% the law of man.
Mm-hmm.
So she definitely considered herself divorced from him and never had anything more to do with him as a husband or as a husband. But he continued paying child support for his children. And I'm so thankful to him, because our father didn't support us. Mm. He didn't work to provide for his children. I mean, he got money from the church and the organization somehow, I'm sure, which they probably resented because he kept having more and more kids. Well, my mom too was on welfare in America, in the USA, I mean, even though she wasn't living in America at the time. They would just use an address of a follower that was there. And so there was, I think that's fraud. I think you have to be living in America to be taking those benefits. But she would just still claim that she had an address there and collect whatever the welfare system allowed, and then also lived on whatever Nephi gave her in child support. So I'm thankful to him. Like, he helped feed me as a child. That and the U.S. government. It wasn't my father. When I got old enough, then I had to support myself. At 9 or 10, I was put to work. But but anyway, I'm jumping ahead.
No, that's okay. I mean, what a guy, Nephi, to just agree to that. I don't know if he really agreed or if it was just kind of forced on him, but either way,
he was a firm believer.
Wow.
So
that is so wild to me. And
yeah.
I'm wondering if they practiced any sort of temple rituals like the mainstream Mormons do, because I know that was brought about in Joseph Smith's time. Joseph Smith introduced the temple marriages. Did they do anything like that?
We never had temple. We never had a temple. We never even had churches, but they did have ordinances. They would practice
sealings,
celestial marriages, and sealings and things like that. So they definitely thought they had priesthood authority to do all of that outside of a temple.
Okay.
They just did it in people's living rooms.
Interesting. Did you ever witness that? I wonder what it looked like, because I know that the temple ceremonies were so incredibly different in Joseph Smith's time.
So I don't know that we did temple ceremonies. I think you're referring to like that part where the bowels and the throat. My mother did talk about them. She had been raised in the modern day LDS church back in the day when they still had the ceremonies where they had to pantomime cutting your throat and cutting your bowels. If you were to talk about the ceremonies or break
your ordinances.
So she definitely would talk about them.
Interesting.
We had baptisms, but we had baptisms in really weird places, like in a lake or in an above ground pool that someone, you know, put in their yard. Or I remember once in Colorado, we dug a big hole in the backyard and filled it with water to do baptisms.
Oh my gosh.
So it was just such a ragtag, dumb organization. It was just like, again, I'm baffled. I continue, people really believed in this. Like, it just is so baffling to me as a grown up, which, you know, even when I ran away from the organization when I was 19, it all resonated with me and kind of made sense. I'm jumping ahead again. Sorry.
That's okay.
Backtrack me. Take me where I'm supposed to. Tell me where you want me to be.
Okay. We'll get back to when you escaped. I want to know, because Anna said she didn't even meet Ervil until she was 8 or 9 years old. Did you have memories of him as a child?
Anna doesn't remember him when she was younger, but I was about 5, so Anna would have been born. She just has no memory of him for sure. Mm. Her first memory of him was when she was 9. But I definitely was a little girl in Ensenada. And it was around that time when we were in Ensenada that we had to start calling him tío.
Oh, because of the law?
Which means uncle in Spanish. Because the law was after him. I guess so. This must have been after he had killed Joel, his brother Joel, my uncle. And so we had to not call him daddy. But when we were, even before that happened, I remember being super excited when he'd get home. When he would come around, that is, I say he didn't like come home every night, but when he would come around, we would run, daddy, daddy, daddy. And he would pick us up and he would bounce us on his knee and he paid a little bit of attention to us and it was sweet. And he was very tall. He was like 6'3", 4", I don't know, tall. And so as a little tiny girl being 4 or 5, I remember him putting us back to back. He would, you know, take us and put us on his back and jiggle down like a slide. And we thought that was super fun.
Yeah.
So I remember him giving us a little bit. I mean, and then once he was done, he was done. And then he was off to his more important things, you know, with the kingdom of God and his pamphlets and writings and all of that. And then when we would see him, we were in awe and we knew he was special because my mom would take whatever food money she had and buy him steak and buy him, you know, cheese. And we're just eating beans and mush and tortillas and just the most basic foods just to keep us, you know, surviving at potatoes sometimes, but very, very sparse diet. But when he was there, she somehow had the money to buy. I don't know if he gave it to her. I don't know how, but he would buy special food. And I remember just sitting, watching, smelling the steak and wanting a bite. And I think one time I did actually get a bite. And I remember it was really gristly and I was chewing and chewing. And I'm like, that's not so good. I didn't love it as much as I thought I would. Cause you know, it's like, what do you do with this after you, you know, finish chewing and it's still there. And but then one after Ensenada, we rarely saw him. We did sometimes, but when he showed up, it was unexpected and we had to be really hush hush and we had to make sure all the windows were closed. And usually again, we didn't decorate. So if there were no drapes, we literally just took sheets and tacked them up over the windows because we could not have someone spying on us and seeing Ervil in there.
Yeah.
Because he could get picked up by the police. And, you know, the police were actively searching for him multiple times in my life. I can recall them coming in, breaking in and, you know, holding their guns, you know, how you do see in the shows and coming through the doors and pretty dramatic, but they definitely were trying to find him. But anytime I was any part of a raid, he was never there.
That must have been terrifying. And what an interesting contrast between these happy, lovely memories that you have of your father, which is the first that I've actually, I think, the first I've heard of anyone in a fundamentalist polygamous family. Usually the dad is very abusive. And it's interesting that you have these lovely memories of him while simultaneously he is putting hits on people and actually killing people. I mean, in the documentary, it mentions that, was it his daughter, a pregnant daughter that he killed?
Yeah.
It's so terrible.
So tragic.
I can't imagine what that must have been like for you when you realized who your dad really was. Do you remember how old you were when you found out?
I was in my late teens. It was probably not too far away from the time when I finally ran away. I know I didn't know in my childhood ever. I didn't know anything. The first hint I got of foul play was about Rebecca, but I didn't know at the time. We lived in a house with, of course, a lot of kids and a lot of other people and wives and, you know, whatever. And Rebecca was living there. And I remember she was a little bit scary to me because she would tell us really strange things. Like she would sit us down and get really serious and warn us about the color red and how it's from the devil. And we didn't know any of that. So that was just really scary and hard to hear. And it's like, so what do you do about if you, I literally in my mind was like, well, what if a light turns red, you know, at a stoplight, you know, yeah. I mean, it's like, what do you do about that? And I was just like, got sucked into that a little bit and it was frightening. But, the sad thing is that Rebecca was not mentally well. And she was creating problems in the organization. So when I say she wasn't mentally well, I know because I was there and I remember how she would talk about these things that didn't really make sense and weren't true. And other people noticed other things. So it's very well known that she was not mentally well. She was expecting her second child. I think in the documentary, I gave the wrong age. I think she was a little bit older than I said. I think she was married as a second wife to one of dad's followers when she was 17, and she was pregnant with her second child. And because of her mental illness, she couldn't escape the way you should quietly get away. She was saying, she was demanding and threatening and it just because she wasn't mentally well, she needed help. She needed medication. She needed, you know, it wasn't her fault. But in our cult, you can't go get medical help because mental illness is equated with devil possession. Mm. I said earlier that our mother would say, feeling sorry for yourself is the first sign of insanity. And she would use Rebecca as an example later in life. So she really warned us against that. And now I understand her true fear of that was because she probably knew that Rebecca became problematic and a blood atonement was carried out on her and they had to silence her. They couldn't go get her help because she would tell people what the reality was that was happening in our organization. They just couldn't let her go to the police. And I say they couldn't, obviously, and they should have, but it would have taken down the whole, you know, organization and dad was at risk of getting caught. So that's the way they eliminated that problem.
Wow, that's so sad.
It's just sickening.
And you found out about that in your teen years?
Yeah. Well, I did not know about that. No. I was about 10 when it happened because I was living in that house in Dallas that she was in. I just remember we had a very unstable life. People came and people went and it was like really normal. But she wasn't there one day and I had no idea what happened. It was just normal for us to have people come and go all the time, like daily. It could change who was in the house. And so I didn't think anything of it, didn't know anything happened. But then about a couple of years later, I'm jumping ahead. I don't know if this is, I mean, but I remember my sister Lillian, who I was living with at the time, she said to me, just in this little kind of high pitched voice, she said, so do you know what happened to Rebecca? And she said it in this tone that made me realize that I did not want to know. And never in my wildest dreams as a child did I think it meant she died
yeah.
or was killed. But I told her, no, I don't know what happened to Rebecca. And then I did not want to ask her what happened. I just let it lie. Mm-hmm. And I'm so thankful that she didn't expound upon it, because that was going to be way too much for a little 12-year-old. And she was sensitive enough to know that. But I was living in the house, so I understand why she thought maybe I had heard something or I knew. But no, I had no clue. And so when she said that, I was thinking, did she get lost? Did she get burned? You know, burn her leg? Did she, you know, I was always thinking about these horrible things that could have possibly happened to Rebecca. And I never dreamed that it was like, no, she was murdered.
Yeah.
It was years later that I think I was like 18. And I found an anti-Mormon pamphlet when I was serving my mission in Utah. So some of our missionaries, in some two male missionaries, went to someone's house, and the investigator is what we used to call them, whose house they were at, had a big conversation with them about how the Mormon church wasn't right, and gave all kinds of pamphlets to them. And they brought it home, and they brought it back to the mission house, and they were just sick and devastated, and their eyes were, I mean, their faces were like ashen, and they were talking to, in this case, Dan Jordan was his dad. He was calling his dad and saying, what about this? And what about that? And asking questions about how can this be true? If this man told us these things. And apparently Dan was able to talk him down and make him feel better somehow. I don't know. I wasn't part of that conversation. The document that I got, it was anti-Mormon propaganda type stuff. But one of them was about Irva LeBaron. And I don't know why. I don't know why that is. But in that document, I read some quotes that my half-brother, someone quoted him. He was strangling her, and she was just, gosh, she just won't die kind of thing. And I read something like that. And I just remember this, my whole body just like, my blood ran cold and my knees grew weak, and I became like nauseous, and I felt sweaty. And I just remember that in that moment, I remembered back to when I was 12, mm-hmm. and Lillian had said to me in that tone of voice that frightened me, do you know what happened to Rebecca? And then I read that, and I said, oh my gosh, this is true. Whereas I could have passed it off as like, of course Eddie didn't do that. There's no way he would have done something like that. But because of she had said that to me, I pieced the two together, and I said, that really was, that happened. Cause it was like a court document that, that these people had shared. And that's when I kind of solidified in my mind, oh my gosh, people were killing.
Did you continue your missionary work after that? Or is that when your shelf started to get a little too heavy?
That was definitely put on the shelf, and that was a hard one to try to figure out. And it was within a year of that I ran away for a lot of other reasons, okay. But that was definitely part of it. We probably should go into the Michael's Appliance era first, because we moved around so much. From Dallas, we moved to Michael's Appliance in Colorado. Well, we lived in California even before Dallas. We were in Bakersfield, California, I think, in a little one-bedroom house with my mom and just her kids. And it's a little one-bedroom house, so you can't fit that many kids in the bedroom. So we had a detached garage that was totally unfinished that we just got parked in there to sleep and to have all our stuff, because the house is teeny tiny. And I remember whenever the landlords were going to come and pay a visit, we had to leave. Like, my mom would like go run to the school and play at the park, or, you know, we had to leave. Just go do something else. You can't be at this house, because they, of course, she said she had one child or something. So, so we had a hideaway, and, she didn't trust us to just sit in the garage and be just super quiet, you know? Mm-hmm. So we had to literally leave. And that only happened a couple times, but I remember when we first moved into that garage bedroom, they sprayed it out with a hose, and there were black widows and stuff. Oh. I remember always being afraid at night that a black widow was going to come out.
Yeah.
One time someone came down the alley and was trying to get in the garage when we were, you know, really late at night. He was talking to us through the because the alley was where, you know, the big door swung open, which we didn't use it for a car, obviously, but that would be for a car to, you know, drive out. And this creepy man, probably drunk, I don't know, came and was talking to us through the crack, you know, in the door and saying, let me in. I know you're in there.
Oh my gosh.
I know you can hear me. Open it up. I'm a nice, you know, trying to sound real sweet and nice. And I don't know what all he said, but I just remember laying just in complete and utter terror and thinking he could get in. Like, I don't even know if the door was locked, if he'd have gotten in the yard. And I lay there frozen for a long, long, long time after we thought he went away, just to make sure he went away or he might try to talk to us again. And then I finally was like, in a squeaky, trembling voice, called my sister's name. And once she knew I was awake, she had courage now, because before she was just laying there frozen too, but it gave her courage. And so we grabbed each other by the hand and we ran through the door into the house. And apparently that door was not locked. So, I mean, this was just, you know, a little bit silly, crazy way to live. But my mom, you know, she just always had faith in God. So she wasn't worried about things like that too much. And so we ran into the house and woke our mom up and told her that this man was trying to get in the garage. Anyway, she got all her kids up and brought us in the house. And from then on out, we just slept on the dirty living room floor. But that felt safe. We just kept our, you know, our clothing and stuff in the garage. But yeah, we, and in this house had, was full of roaches, you know, those big flying ones, like infested. Ooh. So, and it was still better than a garage with black widows potentially. So
yeah,
we preferred that. So yeah, she did care about us. She was just too just trusting. There was a lot of things that we were allowed to do, like running off to the park by ourselves, you know, and just different things. Even when I was a little girl, I remember going to the park with my sister a year older than me. And I'm really, really lucky. There were some inappropriate things that happened. There was a man who picked us up and was touching us, and never told anybody else, but he was very, very inappropriate with us. And I'm just lucky, very, very lucky that worse didn't happen. So I'm always just sitting grateful. My older sister had the wisdom, because we didn't know how to get away from this man. And we taught you, you know, you're supposed to obey adults, and it's very awkward and uncomfortable. And we didn't know what to do. And she said, "Oh, I hear my mom. We got to go." And took me by the hand and got me out of there. So, it was pure neglect. That should have never happened. In fact, when we moved out of that house in Bakersfield, when my mom moved away from there, she had a truck that she loaded up to get us moved to the other house we were moving to, because we moved all the time. She had to leave my sister, a year older than me, and I. She left us at this house while she went and took belongings and kids to the other house. And I was in third grade. So I was maybe 8 and my sister was 9, and left us there overnight in a very, very impoverished, like scary little town area. And strangely enough, the landlady popped in, probably because my mom owed her rent, I'm guessing. I don't know why she showed up while we were there alone in this house. And of course, then she knew that my mother did not just have one child in this house, because she'd never seen us. And she was just super kind, super sweet, super kind. We're like, oh, what are we going to do with a stranger? We can't tell her anything. We were always taught to be afraid of everybody. It wasn't part of our religion. And so it was very scary. So she ended up leaving. So we thought, okay, we're going to be fine. We're going to be fine. And she came back. And she came back with this little golden sofa so that she could stay and sleep there with us, so we wouldn't be alone. And she made us hamburgers and took care of us. And she never confronted my mom that I'm aware of.
What?
In the morning she left. But can you imagine what a tender-hearted, sweet lady? A lot of bad, terrible things could have happened to us. We were two little girls left alone overnight. And in a little scary area. People weren't kind to us in that area. So anyway, I once confronted my mom about it. It's like, how were we so neglected? Why weren't you supervising us? What? How were you okay with that? And you know the story of Anna. She's already talked to you about her running away.
Yeah.
And my mom, we're in Houston, and she's leaving back for Denver. Her daughter is 13 years old, and she leaves to Denver anyway. Like, what kind of brainwashing do you have to experience? This is a mom who really does love her children. But that's why And I knew that. I knew. I always felt loved by my mom, even though she allowed such brutality because of her religion. But I once did confront her as an adult with more than one thing. I got apologies from her before she died. And they were sincere and it really helped me. But I just said to her, why were we allowed to just run around and not be taken care of? And she said, well, I trusted God. And this, as an adult, that piece inside of me is like, but God sent you these children to take care of. He didn't like just send them for you and now I'm going to take care of them. I didn't ever confront her that hard, but that is what my thoughts were. It's like, and then I became a mom who was like super vigilant and super, you know, always wanted to keep track and always wanted my babies near. Like I got to be a stay at home mom because I don't think I could have handled anybody leaving my babies with anybody because of how I was raised and all the dangerous situations that we were put into.
Well, and also on the other side of neglect was the being put to work. So not only were you neglected in ways, you were actively put to work and made to do things at such a young age. Do you want to talk about that at all, that job?
Sure. So that was, we have Mexico and then California, multiple houses. And then we have Dallas, multiple houses. And then from Dallas, we were loaded up in the back of a big box truck and driven to Colorado. And in this situation, we were actually reunited with our mom. And that's when we were introduced to Michael's Appliance, which was a big warehouse where we had a showroom floor where all the used appliances that had been refurbished and scrubbed clean were placed so that the salespeople on the floor could sell these pristine appliances. And what people didn't know is that it was just in the back. It was just a sweatshop and where there was a lot of child labor going on. The boys had a section where they had different sections, you know, for fixing appliances, and some were told to learn how to fix washers, and there were stoves and there were refrigerators and dishwashers and just large appliances. And so some of the boys and older girls, women would work mostly in the repair. And then they would take these filthy appliances. They were sometimes not filthy, but sometimes they were really filthy. And they would take them to the cleaning department where it was full of little girls. I was about 9 or 10, I guess, when I was put full time in the warehouse, except when I was in school. School was not mandatory in our organization. It just depends on what they needed. And so sometimes I was in school, sometimes I wasn't, you know, all throughout my life. Sometimes I did go to Mexico and I did go to school in Mexico and went to first and second grade, which I think is great because, you know, I learned my Spanish and learned how to read in Spanish. But now we were in Colorado under Dan Jordan, who was like the leader over that segment of Dad's cult. And he had always been, from the time I was born, he was always the second in command with my father. And he was a brutal taskmaster. He was not a kind man. And there was a lot of terrible abuse that happened there. And I loved school. I was always a good student. I always wanted to go to school. So mostly I got to go to school while I was in Denver most of the time. And I loved it. And we got free lunches, which were amazing.
Yeah, I bet.
We survived because we were not really paid. Sometimes every now and then would pay you a nickel for cleaning a dryer, you know. And most of the time you didn't. They would talk about paying you and then they would stop, you know, after they'd pay you 1 week and then pay you your dollar or whatever, for, you know, whatever. It was just so silly. Most of the time we weren't paid anything ever. My mother was just barely given food money to live off of. And I guess they paid the rent. We moved into a house that we looked it up. We Googled it later, Anna and I did. And we said, that house on Xavier, like, how big was it? How did we fit 20 kids into this house and three wives? We Googled and it was 1500 square feet.
Yikes.
But it had a living room, and a living room, you can fit a lot of kids on a filthy floor. So the warehouse was dank, filthy, cold, miserable place, concrete floors. And we had 10-year-olds in there with products that say, keep out of reach of children, like literal muriatic acid. Like that is caustic. And we would use it on like the lids to the washing machines to take off the hard water stains and things on them. And we used Easy Off Oven Cleaner in the ovens to clean those, which they were so, that was the worst, because I could almost handle the muriatic acid better than I could, because the muriatic acid, you had to be really careful. Like, it would steam your hands if it stayed on your hands. So you had to be very careful, but the Easy Off Oven Cleaner would too. And it was super fumy, and you had to like get into the oven to spray it and coat it well in order for it to soften the baked on stuff that was there. And so little children, we used, you know, touch up paints and spray paints. And we had this, in one corner of the stove of the warehouse, there was this huge 40 inch, really old timey, you know, how the round cornered stoves were, and a huge galvanized tub in it that fit across the 40 inch stove. And it was something in there, some black bubbling stuff. I think it was called Okite. That's what I remember. It was called Okite, and it would sit in that corner, and these little children would go to this big tub of this bubbling Okite, and we would wrap the grates from the tops of the stoves and the racks from the ovens to clean them. We would tie wire them together and dip them into that big tub. And then you had to make sure that part of the wire was hanging over the edge so that you could fish them back out, because you can't reach your hand in there to grab it. And it's not, I mean, you'd have to get a shovel or something to get them out if you allowed yours to slip off of the wire and go into it. But it softened things so that we could easily clean them. So, and then you had to time it, and you had to figure out, you know, how long. And I remember, like, with the muriatic acid, if you left it too long, it would eat away at the porcelain. So it was like, you could ruin these machines. And so there was a lot of stress. And I just remember and by the way, we were there from 9 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night for those of us who were, you know, LeBaron children. And that was, even during the school year, when those of us who were allowed to go to school, we had to spend those 12-hour days every Saturday. And oftentimes after school, we would go as well. So we'd go to school all day and then go to the warehouse to scrub. And Dan Jordan's children would sometimes show up. And I was really excited and hoping that he had a daughter that was my age, and we were like super best friends, and I really loved her. And I didn't know if she was going to show up or not, because Dan's kids weren't always there. But I would always look forward to Saturdays when maybe I would get to see my best friend. But when they came, they would come at like noon. They would come, you know, with their hamburgers that they would pick up, on the way there. And they would work alongside us for a few hours, and then they would get to go home. And we were there till 9 o'clock at night. And all we had to eat literally almost every single day of our existence in that, you know, in that warehouse was, bean sandwiches. We would take stale bread that we got really, really cheaply because it was out of date, and, mashed beans with some mayo. And we didn't have baggies, and we didn't have lunch boxes. We just had the sandwich bags that the bread came in. I mean, mm-hmm. not sandwich bags, the bread bags that the bread came in. And then we would take all the bread out. We would lay it out, put mayo and put, you know, mashed beans in them, slap them back together and put them in the bag, and then carry them, or they would just all mush down because they were so heavy. So like, yeah. Smashed bean sandwiches was what we had every day. And then we would have peanut butter too. I don't remember Dan Jordan ever doing this when his children were in the warehouse. But he demanded hard work from these children, and it was super, super oppressive. I do remember I was always relieved when Dan was not there, because sometimes he wasn't there. There was part of the time during our Michael's Appliance days in Colorado where he had been picked up by the authorities, and they were holding him. They were trying to find, I'm sure, I don't know this for a fact, but I am sure they were trying to find other evidence on him to keep him, because they didn't want to let him go after they'd caught him. But they were trying to gather enough evidence, so they kept him on dodging the draft.
Interesting.
So he was never in the warehouse, and it was such a relief. If he thought you weren't moving fast enough, if he didn't think you were working hard enough, he would scream profanities at you. And we were terrified of him. Mm-hmm. Like, he didn't show up, but every now and then, so he wasn't always there, because I never saw him work. He would just come in and scream at people and demand you work. And he would just come at his leisure whenever he felt like it. It was pure brutality. And, you know, he would order people to be beaten. It was rarely me because I was a very compliant, very hard worker. And so I usually didn't get into trouble. But my squirrely little brothers that just, you know, couldn't be reined in, couldn't be kept in line, and just wanted to play and run around and goof off, they got the brunt of it. They got, you know, acting like little children, like they were.
Yeah.
You were not allowed to be a child. You were not allowed to play. And I'm 57, and people look at me and say, you look younger than you are. How is your skin? How do you not look that old? And I just say, well, just be raised in a warehouse. Don't get any sunshine.
Oh, no. The silver lining. I do want to jump forward, though, because I want to know more about your escape. And I want to make sure we have enough time to talk about how you are now.
Yeah.
So when you finally decided to leave, what was going on at the time?
So I'm back in Denver now. We're on a refuse to go. And then Dan decided to open up a mission field. My dad had died, by the way.
Ervil was put in prison and died in prison.
Dad was in prison. He ordered my marriage when I was 14, which didn't happen because before that could be arranged, he died. So I just missed getting married at 14, literally by just, I'm super, super, I'm lucky in so many ways. But I have the order that he gave. A lot of things happened. I ended up back in Colorado under Dan Jordan, who now is the prophet, according to my mother. And he decided to open a mission field. So he took kids he thought were old enough and trained us and brainwashed us. And we went to the mission field. What we had to offer people in the mission field was just a baloney religion. I like to say a bullshit religion. We were having a hard time making converts.
Weird.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah. So Dan and Sherwood would come up to the mission field periodically and make someone a scapegoat for not having the spirit of God. And this is why we weren't converting anybody, not because the religion was crap. And what we had to offer proselytizers was garbage. So they would come to the mission field. And I remember this happened to multiple people before me. And it was really unkind. I mean, they would scream and yell and tell them they didn't have the spirit of God. Like, they have the spirit of God screaming and yelling profanities, right? Mm-hmm. So I just always think, like, why do people want to spend eternity? I didn't think this at the time. I would not let myself have these thoughts. But after getting out for some time, I was like, why did people even want to go spend eternity in the celestial kingdom with Dan Jordan and his wife? You know, like, they were awful and mean and controlling and took everything for themselves and barely gave you enough to subsist on, you know, just keep you alive. Not medical care, not a well-rounded diet, not the junkiest homes. He had three homes in the country that he bought, and then one also that wasn't in the country. So he had owned four homes, and we owned nothing. Like, we were put in little rental houses that were garbage and, you know, just cheap. And while he's over there using our labor and buying himself houses for him, his families, I didn't see all of that then. I couldn't think those thoughts back then, of course. But I was in the mission field, and to go to the mission field, I never had a nice coat ever growing up while I lived in Colorado, just really stupid things that were out of date, so old fashioned. And when I would walk home from school, I would like put it wrong side out and hold it over my arm so that I didn't have to wear it. Anyway, so when I was sent to mission field, they bought me this long, beautiful wool coat, you know, in like an oatmeal color. It was so just beautiful, like a beige colored coat with little puff sleeves. And I just felt so just, I loved my coat. I was finally proud to wear my coat. And they bought you some clothes because we dressed in rags pretty much. And so we had to go out and buy some new clothes for the mission field so that you could present yourself well. Again, I was saying that people would get thrown out of the mission field and castigated and told that they didn't have the spirit of God. And then at one point, again, I knew it would never be me. It had to be justified what was happening to these people because they were right there next to God and they knew. But at one point, they weren't converting people. And I always knew I was striving for the spirit of God and for the celestial kingdom. And I was prayerful and I was studious and I was trying to do all the things really, really sincerely. And, but this time they decided that I didn't, I'm the one that was keeping converts from flocking to us. So it was my lack of the Spirit of God. And during one little meeting with the missionaries, my mom came to this trip. And I think it's because of what they were planning to do to me, because she never came to the mission field. So I think they brought her because they were going to do this to me. But we sat around the table and we debriefed on what happened that day and who we proselyzed to and what happened. And I remember Dan Jordan just made a little off-color joke. And I just only remember him ever saying two off-color jokes. He didn't do that often. But, you know, we were grown-ups. We're in the mission field. We can take an off-color joke. And it was something like, you know, don't make love on a squeaky bed. And I remember thinking, I'm a grown-up. I can take this. You know, it was embarrassing. And I didn't quite even know what it meant because I was super innocent. But I remember just rolling my eyes and saying, very funny. It just in a playful way, thinking, I'm a missionary. I'm right here with the adults. I can get away with this. Just never meaning anything bad by it or disrespectful, really. It was just playful. So that night when I was going to bed, I saw the bedroom that Dan Jordan was staying was closed. I heard voices in there, and he was in there with his wife, his number one wife, I should say, and my mother were in there talking. And so, you know, it was in a finished basement of the mission house, and I got into my little very Puritan flannel pajamas with my companion, and we had twin beds next to each other, and we got in bed and I fell asleep. And the next thing I knew, his wife and my mom were in the bed or in the bedroom next to my bed, and they just said, Celia, roll over, because I guess I was laying on my back. So I rolled over and they swept the blankets off of me and my little thin flannel pajama and began beating me. Mm-hmm. So my mom started, because they required her to, and I guess it was Dan's belt, because it, you know, they had it from, they got it out of his room. So my mom gave me the first 20 lashes. And according to our religion, according to the Bible, you're not allowed to beat anyone more than 40 lashes. So our teaching was you can't go over 39 because you don't want to miscount and displease God. So we did 39 to keep it under the 40 in case there was a miscount. So my mom whipped me, and it was just humiliating and it was so embarrassing. And I'm like 18 years old, maybe even closer to 19. And here my mom is spanking me. In hers, I would call more of a spanking. It was just embarrassing and humiliating. And I'm like a grown up, and here I am, my mom is whipping me. And then after her 20 lashes, she handed the belt to Dan's number one wife, and she beat me. She didn't just whip me. She didn't just spank me. She beat me. She was sending me a message, and it was brutal, and it was just so humiliating. And she said, we are punishing you for disrespecting the prophet. And she put welts in me the next day. I mean, I was bruised. I was welted. It was like really hard to sit down. And they were screaming at me profanities, just ugly, and telling me, you don't have the Spirit of God. And you are, you know, keeping converts from coming into our, you know, religion, joining our religion. And it's all on you because you're keeping the spirit of the devil, which none of it was true. Like, I knew it wasn't true, but it was messing with my mind, because I'm like, but I'm trying so hard and I know my heart, but they just tell you that's not what you really are about.
Yeah.
They're trying to change the narrative of what's going on in my whole being. And my companion knew this. Like, she was very, very sensitive to what was going on. And we had had heart to heart talks about spirituality and about love and about God. And she knew that I was a true faithful believer and doing my best. So the next day we were sent out to preach. I had to go with my blistered butt, get the Spirit of God, and go preach. And she just took the load. You know, she just made sure she did. And I was just ashen. She had to see my face was just ashen. And then the next day was Sunday, and she and I were the companions that were slated to do the talks that day in church. So we had to stand up and give little sermons. And she came to me and very quietly said, Celia, I'm going to take up all of the time so I wouldn't have to get up and try to preach. Because I was still expected to preach, even though I'm full of the devil, Don't ask me why that makes any sense. I was supposed to get my spirit of God going in a hurry and go preach and get up and give a talk. Jeez. And she was just, I could tell that she did not agree with what was happening. She really felt for me. And I knew that. And I really appreciated it. And just appreciate it to this day. But she said, don't worry, I'm going to take up all the time, like I said. And somehow her mom found out who was that first wife, or that number one wife of Dan Jordan's. And she found out that that was the plan. And then she lay into me, screaming profanities at me and saying, you are, it's mind control. You're using mind control on my daughter. Like, her daughter tenderheartedly trying to stand up for me and, you know, help me in this really difficult situation. And now it's mind control. So I didn't even know mind control was a thing. I didn't think we were ever taught that. So this was the first I'd ever heard of mind control. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like, it was really a bad moment because I know where my heart was, but I was told it wasn't there. And I knew they were inspired by God. So I was like, I was confused. It was a real brain fuck. You know, I was gaslighting, like terrible. And so you could question your own inner thoughts and your desires. And that one evening she took me aside, and now in this sugary, syrupy, sweet voice, trying to be sound very maternal with me, she sat me down on the couch after everybody had gone to bed and just had this big long conversation with me about selfishness and about serving God and about, she was like the most selfish person ever. She was the one that got all the bad stuff, you know, while we worked. So, but she's having this conversation about serving God with your heart and your mind and your strength, and have this big lecture, just doing it in these sugary, sweet tones. And then just said, you might just need to accept that you're just not celestial material.
Oh my gosh.
And that was the most devastating thing, because I really was serving with my whole heart and soul. And then to say that all my sacrifices and all my, and I never had a bad thought. Like, I always, you know, if people were stealing, I mean, not stealing, if people were getting more than me and taking more than was their fair share, I was like, I was still willing to serve God, you know, whatever it was. And so for her to tell me that was just crushing. So after that, she told me to keep one dress out of the things that I owned from the mission field. And the rest of it, I was to give away to the missionary that was replacing me, which is also one of her daughters. And so my coat got taken and all my clothes, other than one dress, so that I could have something to wear to church on Sundays, because it's the only thing that's appropriate, and was shoved out of the mission field, flown home in disgrace.
Oh my gosh.
During this stay at the mission field is when I also learned about Rebecca being murdered. And it was within a year I had to get out. And there's a long story around that, but that was really the thing. And then when I got home, I said, okay, if I'm going to be home, then let me finish my senior year. I was a great student. I love school. Teachers are wonderful, blessing on this world. They wouldn't let me, and they wouldn't let me, and they wouldn't let me. They're like, nope, you are full-time work. Who do you think you are, basically, to try to go get your education? All of Dan Jordan's kids were given the option of, you know, high school education. And he always seemed to emphasize the importance of it, but I was not worthy anymore. I had to work full time, and I just begged and begged, and nobody would let me. And I said, well, can I just be paid something so that I can just get a correspondence course? Like, I wanted to go to school. That was my dream, to finish high school. But I was like, well, at least I can get that education, and I'll work hard. I will, you know, just do it after work, and I won't take away from any of my job, but, you know, I can do a correspondence course or something, because we didn't have internet. So, the answer was just no and no and no. And little did anyone know, I had the phone number to one of my sisters in Houston, a different older sister in Houston. So I called her. I used that phone number that I would never have used, because I know that was going against God to talk to an apostate. But I felt like I could keep the number if I just kept it safe in my little box of special things and not use it. Mm-hmm. But after all the beating and not being allowed to go to school and all my clothes being taken and being told I'm not even celestial material anyway, I was just like, I have things I'd like to do. I had a list of goals I wanted to accomplish. So I just kept begging my mom to let me go to Houston, where other apostates had gone to. And every night just crying to her, you know, like, let me go to school. Let me do this. Can I just get paid $75 a week so I can, you know, just help me stay. Yeah. I want to get some things done, but help me stay. And it was like, no, who do you think you are? You don't deserve anything. You're just a slave. They didn't say the word slave, but, you know, you're just a worker, and you just need to accept your place And so then finally, after just crying to my mom every single night and her not having any power to make any change, she under her breath, so I would never go against my mom. And I was to the point where I literally preferred to die than to live there anymore. She just under her breath said, "I guess you better go." And I said I would go for 6 months and accomplish some things, and then I would come back and repent. So that's what she was expecting, and that's what I was expecting. I didn't want to go, you know, I didn't want to die outside of the cult and end up, you know, in hell forever.
Yeah.
But I figured if I could get out and, you know, possibly I could just live a good life and then go to hell later.
Go to hell later.
Yeah. But I always had the option. I could come back and repent. You know, I guess other people had done it.
Yeah.
So I called my sister, and there was a lot more that happened around that. But she bought me a ticket and sent her mother-in-law, who was never part of our organization. She had eloped with a cute boy that she fell in love with, who was not an old man and not a polygamist. Uh-huh. And so they had already eloped ahead of time. And again, I had her number secretly. And so she bought me a ticket, and her mother-in-law brought me $50 when she knew I was going to be home alone so that I could get a taxi to go to the airport and run away. And I did.
Oh my goodness. There's still so much to talk about, Celia. Okay, let's just talk about how you're doing now, and then maybe at another time we can do a follow-up episode to this.
Okay. I am a mother of 3 grown children that I'm very proud of, 25, 27, and 29. Mm-hmm. And the 29-year-old is about to be 30, and then they're all right behind her. So I was on the 2-year plan. I was married for 17 years to their dad, and I've been divorced since 2009, and realized that I don't want to live the way my mom lived. I didn't want to go through marriages. So I have just become a strong, independent woman.
Awesome.
I have a career, and my children love me, and I love them, and I'm a licensed banker. What else? What else do you want to know? What's important?
What do your kids think about all of this, this documentary? And
yeah, they were happy when I went on social media before my name actually got legally changed. We talked about that, right? I changed my name to LeBaron. Yeah. I've been saying that story like over and over now. So they were happy that I changed my name to LeBaron on my social media before it came out. Cause they're concerned about how it could affect them. They just, you know,
sure.
They knew their dad wouldn't like to be associated with any of this, who I've been divorced from for a very long time, but they're very supportive. They're very supportive. And for, you know, not wanting to be associated with it, they're sharing it on their social media.
Yeah.
You know, they're on their Instagram sending, you know,
aww,
putting things out there. So I feel very supportive and very loved by them. They've come to a watch party with me with a very dear friend. And I had 3 watch parties.
That's awesome.
And it's doing really well, which surprises me. It's just us, you know, and our story is not as shocking and dismaying as other people's stories that suffered so much more than we did. But so I live a happy life. I've always tried to find the positive, and I suffered through leaving the mission field. It was in leaving, you know, my religion. I mean, I'm not going to downplay it. There was like depression that I had to overcome, that my sister was just super loving, and her husband super loving and kind through all of that. And and then I went through, you know, a depression when I went through divorce and her separation from my husband. But other than that, so my life is just pretty great, and you overcome it and you get past it and you find happy again.
Yeah.
That's how I've been able to do. So I'm in a really good place, and I'm wanting to do some good in this world and do good for my family. So all my secrecy, not secrecy, but, you know, keeping so much private and not talking about it, I'm just ready now, I feel like. And I hope that we're well received. I hope, you know, there's always this fear that society can turn on you, or that, you know, people will throw hate at you when you become a little bit more public like this. And so there's all of that, but we're doing it afraid. And so far we've just been, there's been an outpouring of love and kindness from almost everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really sweet. And it's like, what was I ever afraid of? People are just awesome.
That's so good to hear. I'm so glad that things are going well, and that the the response has been positive, and I'm sure you're going to feel that from our community as well. We have some really awesome people who always leave kind words for our guests. And so I'm just so happy that you came on and told your story, and you did it alone, which I know was different than what you're used to, but you did great. It was awesome. So thank you for doing that. So with that, I just need your Linda Listen moment, which is a sassy statement you want to say to someone who's pissed you off, or if you want to give our viewers some inspiration, you can do that too.
Yeah, I'd rather end on an inspirational note, saying that you can be born in awful circumstances and your parents can be super, super toxic, but don't let that define your life. Just don't let them choose that as the narrative for your life. Choose your power. Choose, you know, if you can, like, there's mental health issues and things like that. But if you have, if you're able to, just don't give them the power to ruin. Dan Jordan does not get to ruin my life. My dad doesn't get to, you know, define my status as a LeBaron. And there's so much goodness and kindness in the world. Seek it out. It's there for us. And make your life as joyful and as great as you'd like it to be.
That's so great. And I know that you didn't plan this, which makes it even better. That was Anna's Linda Listen as well.
What?
It's so good, like almost verbatim. And I just love it so much that you guys are that close, that you just have the exact same advice. And it's so great.
I did not hear her conversation. I was not even here when she did it. So that is very, that's wonderful. But we've been talking a lot, and we've been very, very close.
Yeah.
So through this whole thing, and we're like, what do we want to make? We just, you know, came to that message, I guess, together.
Yeah, I love it. I think it's great. We'll just double down on it because it needs to be said. So thank you so much for joining us again. And guys, if you want to get in contact, you can find her on Instagram, CK LeBaron. We'll also link her Facebook down below as well, so you can get in contact with her if you'd like. Make sure to leave those words of encouragement in the comments. And do you have any final thoughts before we go?
Thank you. Thank you, Shalice, for having us and for letting us share our story. I hope some good can come from it.
You're welcome. And I'm sure that it will, even just inspiring people. Both you and your sister have just been incredibly inspiring. So we appreciate your time. And
that's so sweet.
For those watching, if you want to support the podcast, just liking, sharing, commenting is extremely helpful. If you want to support even further, we have merch at cultstoconsciousness.com under the merch tab. You can become a patron at patreon.com/cultstoconsciousness. You can come to Costa Rica with us for something a lot less culty and a little bit more fun and adventurous. That's in the description as well. And if you like this video, I will leave two down here below that you can check out. And until next time, follow your highest excitement, be conscious, and be well. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, it would mean a lot if you could like and subscribe on YouTube and leave a review or a comment to help with our visibility. You can also find me on social media at cults2consciousness or reach out by email at cults2consciousness@gmail.com.